Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are speaking with John Paul Lederach, who is author of The Pocket Guide for Facing Down a Civil War, Surprising Ideas from Everyday People Who Shifted the Cycles of Violence. John Paul Lederach, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thank you, David. Good to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for writing the book. I guess I have to start with, are you worried about a U.S. civil war? And if so, why? What are the signs of it?
Well, I get a lot of questions in that direction. That was the opening of the book, was I was trying to respond to the experiences that I've had internationally in settings of civil wars for the last 40 years. A lot of people were asking whether there's a particular case study that's similar, or whether the patterns that are showing up because you see news headlines about civil war here in the U.S. I think if you come into the book, you'll find two things to be true. One, we have a lot of patterns that are concerning, especially around the level of our toxic polarization and the level by which a smaller number of people are actively preparing in one form or another for this kind of event. I think the bigger picture that comes out of that is that there's a lot that we can do to improve and prevent this, that we're not in a place where it's likely to explode, especially in the imagination of the American people that goes back to the Civil War of the late 1800s, which is, you know, a period where our country was divided geographically. And I think that's highly unlikely at this point in the form that it took then. But I do think we have a lot of patterns that are very concerning about the potential for and the use of violence as an option to pursue politics, and that our real challenge is how to create the conditions where we live that really permit us to engage with our deep differences in ways that are nonviolent.
There's one narrow sense in which I always object to the idea of polarization, and that is that the U.S. Congress seems mostly to fund militarism, and it does so with perfect harmony and unanimity. But there is a real sense in which people around the United States are polarized and viewing half the country as an alien population, and people are fleeing the country, which I think is something you note as a pattern in the book, leaving the place.
To go directly to the idea of polarization, it's pretty common for all of us to find and affiliate with groups that we care about and that hold similar views. Polarization as part of a democracy is pretty normal. I think where the key that I've been trying to highlight is the idea of toxicity. When it begins to poison the body politic, and that tends to have two or three outcomes that are pretty similar, a system of sustained toxicity. One is that it creates a lot of paralysis. That's a key outcome. People just feel like they don't know what to do, what to say. They feel very tentative about the ways that they relate with difference. And I think the second is that that these systems live to replicate themselves, that they prove to be very functional for some forms of leadership. Certainly election periods are very powerful, moments in collective bodies where people polarize even more extremely. I think the third element that we have to pay a lot of attention to is that toxicity that leads toward violence depends on dehumanization. And dehumanization is something that we see pretty clearly in a lot of patterns, both in terms of public rhetoric, the ways we talk about others, and the ways we talk about people but don't talk with them. And I think a lot of the message of the Pocket Guide, I use the Pocket Guide not so much as a metaphor for a short book. It is a short book. It won't quite fit in your pocket. But the idea behind it was that a lot of places I've worked, civil wars do not happen miraculously from the top down. They happen by way of sustained preparation and in many localities, geographies where people live. So the message is watch your pockets. Think about where you live. Think about how to engage better and differently with conversations that are significant to issues in your local community, and practice actively the ability and the recognition that dehumanization is never a good route for anything that we have to address, whether it's one side or the other. I think these are common ways that we can learn to listen to understand engage where we have issues that are of concern and be actively involved where you see the patterns of this happening in your local communities. Because the big picture of what I've learned over the years of working in these settings is that it's much harder to end an open civil war of and open violence than it is to prevent it before it happens. And what we need to find ways to do is actually practice the very things that people have to do when they end a civil war, is find their way back to their humanity and find their way back to better conversations and find their way back to politics without violence. And I think those are all, you know, accessible and doable where we live.
I don't know that anybody in the United States gets trained in nonviolence. I can't recall a single Hollywood movie about unarmed civilian resistance, or very many where the answer isn't to kill somebody. We recently saw a man kill a health insurance CEO, and lots of people cheering for it. So it seems like this toxic combination of people frustrated, a so-called representative government that doesn't represent anybody except the health insurance companies, and the normalization of violence, the notion that the only thing you can do is whine and moan or use violence. What did you make of this?
I have a chapter in the book that's titled The Holy Grail of Grievance. And it really focuses in on how grievance becomes not only so prominent, but becomes a justification that we have no other alternative but to move toward violence. This is one of the things that Bettelheim put into a very simple phrase, which is violence is the option of a person who can imagine no other alternative. And I think what nonviolence is really about is imagining other alternatives for achieving the changes that we want. The normalization that violence is present and needs to be accepted is very dangerous. And I think we have to find ways to push back on this idea that we don't have better ways to engage those differences. We live in a country, of course, that has probably globally more significant and open-ended ways to assure the right to attain weaponry, and weaponry that is highly sophisticated, and increasingly weaponry that can be done secretly by way of internet production, that begs us to look as a collective at the ways that we need to create the containers for better holding our conversations and better holding our differences than to move toward violence. And I think the outpouring that we saw of sort of a folk hero kind of a thing is actually a sign of how deep the grievance runs. And that this is really a lot of what I was trying to push forward in that chapter, is that grievance is often has two elements that go with it. It's a form by which the deepest things we care about move toward either defending or blaming and not taking responsibility. And the key to real change is a wider set of people taking better responsibility for the well-being of the collective whole than we have been doing together. And I think that's a demand that we have to make of our political leadership. And this has been the challenge, is that often that toxicity of polarization is what creates the extremes that permit, because we know the pattern of it in polarization is that the more extreme fear of survival and of the other, the more extreme leadership tends to rise and have its platform. And I think we really need to recuperate the space of engaged conversation and better ability to really ask for the responsible ways that both locally and nationally we deal with these issues.
What are the grievances that are driving people in the United States? Because I know we hear all about the things that divide people, the racism and the bigotry, but it just seems so darn simple. If you know, every other wealthy country and lots of poor ones have figured it out. You give people health care, you give people education, you give everybody universally, black, white, billionaires to the majority of people who have nothing, the same thing, and you give them good lives, and so a lot of those grievances go away. What's the problem here?
Well, I certainly think that there are a range of grievances that are very much tied to people's everyday economic life. People feel that they are in a position where they are struggling to survive. And that's a very large number of people in the United States. And that this, the infrastructure of support that we have has not only been diminishing, but has been often ineffective in its capacity to serve the very purposes that it has. So the medical system, for example, people are very frustrated with how complicated the bureaucracies have become and how unresponsive the support systems have become and how expensive this is for the wider life. That particular grievance, I think, it runs pretty deep. A lot of people face this on a daily basis. I think the other elements is that we are in an extraordinary period of change globally and nationally. The emergence of very fast moving high tech abilities for social media to impact the ways that we seek our information, the kind of thing that we're doing now, is clearly more prominent than it was 20 or 30 years ago. But we don't have common locations we go to share out how we're triangulating our understanding of what is true and better and best practices, a whole range of things. And that has come not only into health, it's come into education, it's come into a lot of uncertainty. And uncertainty is often a driver. People not knowing for sure what's coming, they want to revert back to something that was known. So they want to get back to where they were earlier. They have a vision of something having been better. Though many people across our country, I think, especially when you look at issues of class and race, what was in the 1950s was not equally beneficial for everyone. There is a long, long history of exclusion and of harm and of great difficulty that people from backgrounds from African American to Latinos to others of our communities have experienced for decades. And I think the changes that are coming are experienced as being fast-paced, unreliable, and creating a lot of uncertainty. And that then lashes out in the direction of demanding quick answers to things that are often slow-moving variables, especially around the economic ones. The disparities that we have currently are almost unspeakable. I mean, the rise of a billionaire population, and yet the fact that we as an extraordinary country of resources have people at the levels that we have who do not have access to food safety and security, who do not have access to decent forms of housing and access to education for children. These are very deep drivers that require a much better way of coming at that. Violence will never serve us getting closer to better answers. And that's part of the difficulty, is that when that begins to move in the direction that you justify using violence to get to what is essentially the requirement of a fundamental social contract and a fundamental care for the well-being of communities and a nation, this requires us all, and it requires us to come into much better and much deeper conversations and hopefully a little more collective capacity to look at where we get our information and how we share it together. This is a massive challenge. I think that the recent period of elections that we've had is only showing the degree to which everything has really shifted underfoot around information and the way we hold each other accountable.
Even had a threat of violence should he have lost from the guy who won. We're speaking with John Paul Lederach, the author of The Pocket Guide for Facing Down a Civil War. John Paul, you have been involved with and write about examples from around the world. I don't know which you think are most applicable to the United States. I was very interested in this example from Kenya of a civilian-based disarmament movement, because obviously a government-based disarmament movement ain't happening in the United States if the government's owned by the gun makers, but has happened in the UK and in Australia and numerous other countries and worked brilliantly. Is something like that possible in the United States? Or if not, what is?
Yes. So the example you're referring to is actually a group of women in the border area between Somalia and Kenya, the town of Wajir, the district of Wajir. And they had faced long periods of sub-clan warfare, the kind of thing that you would see in your local news around that particular region. And they came together, the women of Wajir came together around a pretty simple proposal, and that was that they had had enough and that it was affecting their children's lives over and over again. They came across their differences of their subclan identities. They focused on a particular question initially, which was how do we assure a safer market? So I just want to take note that among the things that I'm trying to illustrate is that you don't need to think about having the perfect policy at a national level to begin. You can ask the question, what do I have accessible to where I live now? So they started with the idea of a market that was safe to buy and sell, but then they began to keep asking over and again how to expand that. And one of the expansions was into a community-based and led disarmament initiative around subclan armament sales and use and the violence that was present there. Now, to be clear, there are a lot of communities in the US that have begun this kind of thing. So you don't have to think very far. Why do we have smoke-free zones at schools? Why do we have gun-free areas? These are actually phenomena that we see in other locations around the world. The idea of zones of not permitting weapons to come in to a certain area was very much a part of what campesinos in Colombia did. They produced these very clear initiatives that negotiated with people that were using weapons about no longer permitting them into certain areas and certain communities. And that so those kind of ideas are not only prevalent, but they're present and can be engaged in. That does not come as an excuse not to go at the level of Congress and representatives around how we can have better policies, but it doesn't mean you're paralyzed not to do anything where you live. And that's, I think, the message of the pocket guide is watch your pockets, go to where you have access, think about what can be done in the places where you live. And those are the messages that we find over and again. To quote one of my early professors, if it exists, it's possible. That's Kenneth Boulding. And I think what we have is great clarity that these things do, in fact, exist and they are possible. The question is, how do we mobilize an improbable set of people to come around it and push for those changes to happen?
Well, there are lots of great examples in this book. I'm interested at now in this, in the gun-free zones and how much they could be expanded, and could you expand them to everywhere? But peace zones and other nonviolent alternatives. There's an example from Ghana of preventing a war using diplomacy of all things. We have a government that doesn't do diplomacy. There are truth commissions. Maybe we need a preemptive truth commission. We need a truth commission now before things get any worse. I don't know. What ideas do you think are most useful?
Yeah. Well, what you've just touched on are all various chapters within this little book to give examples of how that happened in places and give specifics on some of the ways that they did those that could be thought about with reference to the patterns. I personally think that among the areas that we need to give a lot of attention to, one is how not to walk away from harder conversations and develop ability to be in better conversation with people who don't think like you do, but who live in your own area. In Colombia, we referred to these as the improbable dialogues. Improbable meaning that a small set of unusual people came together who, as individuals, were known to be close to one or another side of the ideological and identity divides. Now, one of the ways that you face down toxic polarization is that if two or three or a half dozen people who are perceived to be from different viewpoints come forward with proposals together, it shocks that system. And there's a reason behind it. And that reason is that we tend in deep polarization to listen with our eyes. It's kind of a short phrase to say, I'm looking at you and I'm going to determine first who you're with. And once I know who you're with, I'll know how to respond to any proposal you're making. So I don't listen to the actual quality of your experience or the quality of your ideas. I'm just pigeonholing you into what group you're with. Now, how do you shock the listening with your eyes? Well, So if two or three people show up who are known to be different and they propose something together, I can't immediately pigeonhole it. So I have to do what? I have to take a second look. I have to listen one step deeper. The whole system slows down to try to assess what is this that's coming now from people that normally are absolutely at their throats proposing something together. And that's what we refer to as the improbable dialogue. It's the theory of surprise. You're bringing something forward that doesn't let people just automatically respond to it or write it off because they say, oh, that's from that group or that group. And I think that's one of the keys that we have is how to create these elements that permit us to relook at each other and relook at the problems that we're trying to face and deal with and have a deeper, better, and more sustained conversation about it.
I think there's a lot more potential for this than people are led to believe by their televisions and newspapers. You're supposed to be either a red person from a red state or a blue person. But the independents far outnumber the Democrats and the Republicans. The people who don't vote for any of them, a pox on all their houses, outnumber the people who vote for all of them put together. And the same people who vote for a higher minimum wage and marijuana rights and abortion rights vote for Donald Trump. So people don't line up with the categories we're told. They're mostly united around opposing the status quo and opposing the federal government, as far as I can tell. So, you know, I don't know if that's something useful to unite around or not, but I think there's potential.
I very much agree. In fact, I get a lot of calls from different people who are concerned about what's happening in their communities and their places, because obviously the kind of work I do. One of those has been increasingly coming from the health sector. People that who are doctors, nurses, and healthcare givers who are feeling like the level of polarization is starting to create a real impact on the level of quality health that can be provided. They feel very paralyzed. This notion of feeling really paralyzed around what step to take and how to do it. This is precisely the way that I think an improbable dialogue initiates. It initiates by getting people who have a deep concern about a particular thing, but who come from very different lived experiences and viewpoints and areas of specialty. And when a few of those can come together, so I make a case historically in my work that moving quickly to the idea of the critical mass, a large number of people that somehow are finally arriving to change everything, has never been my experience. What I've experienced is what I call the critical yeast, the smaller number of people, the smallest ingredient that somehow helps everything else grow. And if you get a really interesting small mix of unusual people who begin to stay together, even though they have differences, and come to common proposal that they can make out into the public, this has an impact of increasing the optimism that people have, the openness that people have, that something different can be done around the issues that are paralyzing our community. And I think of all the things you mentioned earlier about people actually leaving the country or leaving, their areas, one of the most complex elements we have is, you know, in international work around wars, we call it internally displaced people. That would be people who are impacted by a war setting who leave, but don't leave their country. They just have to go to another part of their country. And that's called an internally displaced person. I'm beginning to see patterns of internally displaced health workers. That is that people are beginning to say, I don't think I can work according to my vocation here. And they're beginning to ask where to go and how to navigate. I think that if you want a red flag, that's a red flag that says we need a better and deeper conversation about the well-being of our communities and the well-being of our children with reference to the fundamentals of who we are choosing to be as a people, and that actually has a better chance of starting locally than a perfect policy can ever do from the national level. So I'm a big advocate for improbable dialogues, focus on something that's worth focusing on, and bring together unusual people. Those kind of elements, I think you can find them over and again throughout the country.
There is a problem with the federal government telling states and localities that they can't have a sane healthcare system. They can't do this or that because the federal government knows better. And the last time the nation that became this huge United States had a civil war, it was over states trying to leave. But if Vermont or California or some state wanted to leave and have a decent, humane sort of governance and foreign policy, I would certainly be asking to go with it. You know, I mean, is that crazy? Why is secession the worst thing? Why is that worse than war or genocide?
Well, it's an interesting question because secession tends to have a couple of challenges that are not looked at. One is macro and one's more micro. The macro one is that we have extraordinary amounts of forms of interdependence around really big and massive issues. How we share water, how we produce and use energy, how we work with highways. There's all kinds of things that connect us that are big picture things, not the least of which are really challenging global ones like nuclear weapons and where they're actually located in the United States. So those will be questions that are at a massive macro level. At a micro level, I think one of the biggest questions that people don't look at when they start talking secession is the enormous diversity that exists in every place that we live. There is no place you're going to go where you won't have the same things that you're facing. And you don't have to go a whole lot further. We talk red and blue as if it's a massive difference. Go down to the numbers and look carefully. When people use a phrase like the people voted or the people have given a mandate, it's 48.9% to 47.8%. Even in places like Kansas or wherever you want to go, look carefully at the extraordinary diversity that exists within those communities, within urban-rural divides. They exist within states. So secession is a complex thing that's driven by the actual quality of relationships we have. And the issue is not whether we'll get a better relationship by being apart. The issue is, how do we create a quality of relationship that respects and brings dignity to the communities we live in? That will remain a question. And I think secession is a quick answer to a complex question that doesn't fully address what's there.
We've got about a minute left, and I wish we had 10 hours, but my concern is not to rid the world of the need to get along better with neighbors I disagree with. That's eternal. My concern is a government that doesn't represent me or my neighbors at all. How do we get past that?
I think we get past it by starting where we live. I share a portion of what you're describing because I think there's a lot of unresponsiveness that happens the further and the more distant it becomes from our daily lives, which is part of the grievance. I think the inverse requires a much deeper engagement from the bottom up. And I think that's been one of the things we've placed far too much attention on national electoral periods and far too little attention on the daily making of democracy. And that's where we really need to go if we want change to happen.
Good advice. We've been speaking with John Paul Lederach, and the book is called The Pocket Guide for Facing Down a Civil War, Surprising Ideas from Everyday People Who Shifted the Cycles of Violence. This has got stories from around the world you can learn from. I recommend it highly. John Paul, thank you so much for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you. Appreciate it, David.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.